central electronic piece of equipment that dates back, I believe, to the early 50s. And it says on it, SSSC. What the heck is SSSC actually mean? Oh, boy. I remember this, Dick. You remember this? Over.
Here, repeat those letters phonetically, Mel.
Sugar, 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 Charlie.
You're going to have to tell me. I don't recognize that one.
Single sideband suppressed carrier.
Ho-ho. I should have recognized that. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, I was just testing you guys. That's exactly suppressed. Single sideband suppressed carrier, known as SSB today, when it was first introduced by Central Electronics, I managed to have one of those. It was called the 10A, and it was a real contraption to put it together as a kit, and that was the early beginnings of it. Most people, if you got on the air, even though it was authorized, said, what in the heck are you doing with that nonsense? Nobody could unmake, most people couldn't copy it anyhow, but it was a fascinating piece of equipment from the early 50s, Dick. Okay, I guess we'll go on with the TechNet.
I believe that piece of Central Electronics, single sideband generating equipment, which was some of the very early days, I think it operated by the phasing technique, not by the filtering technique. I think it was a so-called single, I'm trying to remember the name of the technique it used, but it was a phasing technique of a pair of doubly balanced mixers, and I believe it had a very pure sound to it. Isn't that true, Mel? Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, phasing machine, and let me tell you something. It was a pain in you-know-what to keep that thing working correctly. It was always drifting, doing this and that. And it was, like I say, an early version. It was a very fascinating way, you know, that guy by the name of Dick Shaum, I believe, the guy who was came up with the first design, was in, you know, early QST, and then he put it together, he put it together as a kit, and have a grand old time with it. Didn't run very much power, so most people were adding amplifiers on and all kinds of things, Dick, over.
There is a special issue of the IEEE proceedings somewhere around 1952 or so, I don't know the exact year, where the hold-on issue was devoted to single sideband. It was just starting to become very popular in those days. They suddenly realized it had tremendous capability. And in those days, they discovered there were essentially three separate techniques for generating single sideband. One is the filter technique that we all use today 99% of the time. The other was the phasing technique, which is now called image phasing mixer. You Google those particular words, image phasing mixer. Study that, understand it. That is a valuable piece of information if you want to do exotic kinds of processing. By way of an image phasing mixer, you could develop the equivalent of a filter, which has the steepness of skirt that is just absolutely unrealizable, but an image phasing mixer can do that for you. And the third technique was the Costas technique. So single sideband can be developed by Costas, phasing, and by filtering. And I'm a little bit amazed that the image phasing mixer technique has not caught on now that there are some very high performance, solid state mixer circuits that are tiny little integrated circuits you can buy these days. So I think the phasing technique should be given more consideration than it has in recent times. Everybody has traditionally climbed onto the filtering bandwagon, and that's not the only way. It requires a pretty exotic filter. It's not the only way, and it may not be the best way. We just keep going down that road for traditional reasons. Paul, I think NASA has been doing some interesting things. I believe the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer is now installed. I believe the shuttle is about to come back home. Give us a little bit of an update. WS2N, our space expert, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, yeah, well, yeah, they're going to disconnect from the International Space Station Earth. Actually, tonight around 12 o'clock, they're going to separate. But that'll be the last for Endeavour. When that comes back, that's it. And then we've got one more flight after that, Atlantis, in a couple of months. So the good news is, as of Tuesday, there was an announcement, and it came out of NASA. Charles Bolton, he's now the NASA administrator, and he came out with an announcement that said that we are now going to have a real space program a manned space program by the United States. Everybody figured, well, this thing is canceled. I've been saying, well, there's been rumors and talk that they want to do something for a long time. Sure enough, they came out with an official announcement that they're going to utilize what's left of the Constellation program, which is the Orion spacecraft, and just redesign it to become the multi-purpose crew vehicle. Let me drop it. Now, the multi-purpose crew vehicle will be the official name as of now. They won't call it the Orion. It'll be built by Lockheed, and what they plan on doing is being able to send this thing into deep space with four astronauts on board. You might remember the Orion was designed to have up to seven astronauts on board. They were going to have like two decks, and they would be able to bring people up to the International Space Station. Well, this has nothing to do with going to the space station. There's contracts that have been given out to SpaceX and others, private corporations, which are actually developing spacecraft, such as the Dragon spacecraft that will bring crews up to the International Space Station for the United States, maybe 5-6 years down the road. So that's not going to be interrupted. What this is entirely new. They're going to use this multi-purpose crew vehicle to be able to go into deep space, and the crew vehicle is able to accommodate four for 21 days. And it will be able to actually leave the orbit of Earth. And where will it might go? Let me drop it. 21 days, it's not going to, you can go to the moon. You can go to the Lagrange points. There might be satellites out there they might want to work on. You can go to possible asteroids that might come near Earth, although highly unlikely. Well, that usually takes about a month or two. So what's in their mind, they want to develop living, habitable quarters to be able to be flown, and then the crew vehicle would be able to dock with that, and they would essentially abandon the multi-purpose crew vehicle for, it'll be attached to this thing, and they'll live in this habitable compartment for weeks, months, and years, maybe, because the ultimate goal is to use this thing for Mars missions. To do any of this, like to the asteroids, you need plenty of time. So, and living space, you got to remember this. Still tight quarters. Apollo was what I think around 300 cubic feet of the living space. Let me drop it. WS2N. Thing is about 100 cubic feet bigger. It's pressurized. It's got twice that volume, but livable areas are usually about half of it when it comes to these capsules. So you probably got 600 cubic feet pressurized, and maybe 300 or 400. That's livable. So at least now they have something in mind. Lockheed's going to continue on with what's left of that Constellation program, which is the Orion. They're working on a lift vehicle. I haven't heard anything yet. I guess probably they'll go with the Atlas V, which is the biggest vehicle that we have now. But it sounds like they're thinking about something bigger, but I don't know. I can't find anything on that yet. They'll also probably, it's talk, not by NASA, but another group, maybe they'll need a backup to get to the space station. Then they would probably use a Delta rocket, a smaller rocket, to do that. So there you go, Dick. A future manned space program. It's not lost like we thought it was 100%. Bringing this back to you, Dick. WS2N Space Report.
Okay, so our new NASA administrator, Charles Bolton, has said there's really going to be a manned space program. We're not going to be doing everything with pilotless vehicles, unmanned vehicles. However, sounds like he's going to be putting man in space in places other than the International Space Station. What's your guess as to what the goals of the manned space program is going to be? Where is that man in space going to be placed and put? Over to you, Paul, if that happens to be mentioned. You got a Paul.
There was a recent, an updated report that talks about possible trips to the moon. Right now they would be able to do an Apollo 8 type or Apollo 10 type where just to orbit the moon and come back. You would need a landing vehicle to do anything different. Or to Lagrange points where there's satellites. We have satellites at certain Lagrange points now, and there's going to be some in the future. James Webb telescope comes to mind. That'll be a million miles out, about four times the distance of the moon. You could send a craft there to work on it. Like I mentioned before, asteroids, but that you're going to need a living habitat to be attached to this crew vehicle, multi-purpose crew vehicle. And, to do that, they would launch that separately on another heavy lift vehicle. And then you would have probably similar to what they did with the LEM, but picture the LEM, maybe 10 times bigger, the LEM, which was the craft that landed on the moon. Figure that maybe 10, 15 times bigger than what it was, and have this crew vehicle dock to that, and then you'll have engines on the on that big rocket engine to go to translunar insertion to leave Earth orbit. You'll have that bigger engine. None of that has come out yet. Right now they're just keeping alive this manned vehicle. They put billions of dollars into the Orion spacecraft already, so they're going to use that as a benchmark and take things from that, from that, and just improve on that.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Mel, during the timeout, he said 21 days for the astronauts, planned mission possibilities. I'm of the opinion, Paul, that your grandchildren are not going to see a man touching an asteroid. Might see a man on the moon, but I'm doubtful of that. And I'm extremely strongly of the opinion where your grandchildren will not see a man standing on Mars. If I look at the bang for the dollar, the amount of performance I get, the amount of objectivity and whatever, the safety, if I send a Spirit, Opportunity, or Curiosity, these are the names of the Mars rovers. Spirit and Opportunity are the Mars rovers that are there now. Curiosity is the one that's about to go there. If I send that kind of a vehicle to any of those three spatial objects, asteroid, comet, moon, or Mars, I get a lot of bang for the dollar, and I'm not putting human life at risk. I'll admit that you get a little more observation, objectivity, a little bit more adaptability with a human being there. But the amount of resources it takes to maintain the life of a human being in the hard vacuum of space, let me drop. And the whole time that you're above the Earth's ionosphere, you're being, you're above that beautiful shield. That ionosphere provides a fantastic shield to all kinds of things that the sun and other things in space can occasionally emit. When the sun burps a coronal mass expulsion and sends billions and billions of pounds of stuff at nearly the speed of light streaming through space, there's a whole bunch of extremely high-speed bullets, so to speak. And if you're out there without having a 10 feet of lead between you and that ray that's coming toward you, your body is going to be damaged, and your chances of getting cancer are going to be increased and whatever. The survivability of a man in space above the atmosphere for significant periods of time, above the ionosphere, is not good. And so I'm having trouble believing that these manned missions, moon maybe, for brief periods, maybe. There's two beautiful pieces of science fiction of where we had our famous movie stars going to an asteroid that was going to hit the Earth, and they did something to correct it. Nice science fiction. I'm having great difficulty believing that could become a reality. Maybe I'm overly negative on this one. What do you think, Paul? WS2N, KQLIW?
Well, you need it for the country, support a space program. You wouldn't have the robotic missions going up if you didn't have the manned space program in the beginning. People would have never just, you know, laid out billions of dollars in tax dollars just for that. In fact, when we sent the two Viking craft to Mars, or even the Voyager, the two Voyager spacecraft to the outer planets. Those missions were built on momentum. You know, you had, you know, tons of money going into the manned space program to get to the moon. And all this, you know, when that started to go away, there was technology and money and things left over, and, you know, that they call it momentum, really, that drove these later missions. And then, you know, without that, you can't have one without the other, from what I see. And also, you don't want to see China and India and Russia and all these other countries starting to send people to the moon and who knows where else, out of Earth orbit, waving back at us. Here we are, you know, we started it all. You cannot have that. A couple of, you know, private contractors running around, let me drop it. People to the International Space Station, which we've been, I think it's been up there for 10 years now. That's nothing new. You know, it's okay to have that, but you really need exploration to drive the real science. You probably got more science out of the rovers riding around on Mars, unmanned, bang for the dollar, like you said, than you'll ever get, you know, by putting a manned mission together to go to Mars. When they go to Mars, they'll probably go to the moons first, Phobos, Deimos. They'll probably go there. And then eventually somewhere down the line. Maybe my grandkids will live to see it. But, you know. Wanted to make one other comment, important comment about Spirit. Let me drop it. Mission is 100% over now, by the way. We now have one robotic mission riding around on Mars. Opportunity is up and running, still going. Spirit is not. It hasn't been heard from since March of 2010, of last year. They were hoping it was going to make a comeback. As of about a month or so, a couple of weeks ago, they sent the final signals up to Mars, trying to see if Spirit would respond. It didn't survive that last Martian winter. It was stuck in the sand. They couldn't orient the panels on a proper degree to get enough sun. It just got colder and colder, and they finally gave up with that. So one down, one still running, and another one on its way. Let me drop it. Curiosity will be going up in August. And as far as missions to the asteroids, well, you know, whether they do that or not, I don't know. There is a planned, definitely planned and budgeted mission, I forgot the name of it, 2016, going up to an asteroid, unmanned. It'll get there. It'll scoop some material off that asteroid, first time that'll happen, and bring it back to Earth. One of these missions similar to the Genesis mission that came back, or the Stardust mission that came back that landed in Utah. Let me drop it, WS2N. They'll deorbit. Well, this one will deorbit and probably goes up in 2016. Probably get there. By the time it gets back, it'll be 2023. Coming back to Utah with a couple of ounces of rock. So if you want more than that, you're going to have to send a manned mission. But if you're happy with a couple of ounces coming back, I guess you could wait for that. I'm for gearing this thing up to go to asteroids and to Phobos, and after I'm dead and gone, maybe even to Mars back then at WS2M. Question two.
Yeah, John, recognized. Spirit lost its spirit, and sounds like it's lost the game. Opportunity is still running, and by the way, anything beyond a couple of months was considered successful, and that was, what, 3 or 4 years ago. How is Opportunity doing right now, Paul? Look like it's going to last for a while?
Opportunity, yeah, that's got a long way to go from what I see. That's doing good. And that was 2004, January, beginning of January. Spirit landed, and 2 weeks later, Opportunity landed. So you're looking at a six-year journey with these things. 10 months was it? I think 10 month time frame to get to Mars, and then 6 years riding around on the planet. Mileage wise, the odometer clocked off around 5 miles for Spirit. So not bad. Dug into I think 15 different rocks, chopped away. You know, they have an abrasive tool on it. Did a lot of work. Took pictures of the sun, took pictures of dust devils, you know, little teeny tiny tornadoes going around on Mars. The wind blew the dust off the surface of the solar panels. They thought it was dead. The wind came by, and looked like brand new again. Remember all of that? What a job they were up. They got a big, big bang for their dollar, Dick.
Amen. Very successful project. Go ahead, John.
Yes, I have a question. The amount of space junk that's up there, does NASA have any idea when that stuff is going to start deorbiting? I know it's deorbiting little by little, but it has to have a point where that stuff is going to start falling like rain, because the orbits have to be decreasing, but I don't know at what rate. Has NASA put out any bulletins on that?
It's not NASA, it's NORAD. NORAD keeps track of every single nut and bolt and glove and everything else that's been dropped into space. What is it? What is its exact coordinates right now? When's it going to re-enter? And there is no sudden time and everything's going to be re-entering. It's a little like a person saying that, well, my automobile is 7 years old, everything's going to start to go, I better get rid of it in a hurry. Automobiles don't fail that way. And space junk is continuously coming back. Once you put something into space, whether you drop it out of your capsule during a spacewalk, or whether you intentionally release it, depending on its mass, its area, and where you released it, and what altitude, you have preordained when it's going to come back. So all of it, every single piece of junk, and I bet you there's, if someone told me there's 15,000 pieces of material that are being tracked by NORAD, I'd believe it. Back to you on that one, John.
Yeah, I've been reading some of the NORAD stuff, but I just thought that over a period of time, we have just increased the amount of stuff that's up there, and I figured we're about at the time where it starts to deorbit. I know they've claimed a few pieces have come down, some large pieces, too. But you're right, yeah, wrenches, nuts, they're tracking all kinds of stuff up there. Okay, I just thought somebody might have had some word on that.
Yeah, there's no sudden time when everything's going to come back. Each individual object, depending on the conditions under which it was released, has a preordained time as to when it's going to come back. And anything that's released from a space shuttle comes back very soon. It turns out that when you put a space shuttle in space at the normal altitude of a space shuttle, which, by the way, is quite a bit lower than the International Space Station, they have to do a burn every 24 hours to maintain that orbit. They're low enough in orbit, they're just always touching the top of the atmosphere, and as such, they're experiencing continuous drag. We've got two people now who signed in earlier. That was Don and Ed, and let's go through them right now. Don, W-A-2... Zebra, Oscar Zebra, what would you like to ask the TechNet tonight? In theory, we've got some brain power assembled here. KGRYW in the TechNet. You got it, Don.
Thank you, gentlemen. W-A-2-Z-O-Z returning. Very good net tech, a lot of knowledgeable guys. I have just moved in to a new apartment. I can't get any HF antennas, decent ones. Up. I don't have a railing outside or patio or anything. I decided to go mobile, and I was determining what type of an antenna to use. I tried different mounts. I tried a mount that goes onto the luggage rack, and then I read a little closer, and it said not for use with antennas that require a ground. I was considering a license plate mount, and when I open up the rear of my Jeep Liberty, it will interfere with that. And then I decided to go with a Hustler side mount with the spring. Now, I was reading that no RF devices should be mounted on the right side of the vehicle because of interference with the computer. And then I was going to mount it on the left, but I noticed that the fuel receptacle would be only about a foot away. And I'm not going to put it there. I don't care if it ever happened before. I just don't feel comfortable with it there. And I'm using marine cable, $1.99 a foot, and marine TL-259s put out by the Shakespeare Company, and they were like close to $10 a piece.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Don, you timed out the machine about a minute ago. It's got about a minute and a half timer. But I think I understand the nature of your question. What kind of an antenna can you use on a mobile where you can't mount it here because of the computer on the right-hand side, you can't mount it on the left-hand side because of the fuel receptacle. Everything you can touch is plastic. It's hard to get to any of the real sheet metal. You probably don't have a trailer mount on the car. Let's see how the guys at the Kings County Radio Club have solved this problem. Mel, the vehicle like Don has, I bet you some of your members have gone through that. I know that the screwdriver antenna is a very popular antenna for mobile mounting, but even that antenna, where would you put it on Don's vehicle K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I can only tell you what I've observed. I haven't had that situation on my mobile, but my car, my mobile, one I, my fun car is basically an old Chevy, and but that's only used for my own personal use. It's not the only car. Seems to be that a number of the fellas I've seen at the hamventions and all. If you go to the hamventions like Limark coming up in the next few weeks, well, it's next week, in fact, 6th of June, I believe. If you see what they do, a number of them I observed there actually got down on the floor and looked underneath how it was done. There's a bracket someone marked that attaches to the chassis and swings out right about the edge of the car where the bumper, you know, and the fender or something meets. You can adjust it somewhere around that edge and then put your antenna, any of your antennas, on that mount stick over.
Okay, I never heard of that device. It definitely sounds interesting. If the antenna doesn't have to be mounted too low, if it's substantially above the chassis, that might do it for me.
Yeah, what I think Mel is telling us is that you're trying to get to the metal frame of the car. You would like that to be the ground, the counterpoise, the other half of the antenna, if you know what I mean. You've got to connect to some chunk of metal somewhere to ground the antenna, to shield it, and to act like the counterpoise. What your transmitter and feed line does, on the positive half cycle, you could say it pumps electrons into the antenna. On the negative half of the cycle, it pumps the electrons back out of the antenna. But it's got to pump them from something and to something. And that something is called the counterpoise. The metal frame of the car is a beautiful counterpoise. The plastic portions of the car that you can physically grab onto will not be a conductive counterpoise. You'll end up with a very hot piece of cable, and you'll be lighting up the emission control computer and the computers on the dashboard, something fierce. So any technique by which you get to the frame of the car by way of a trailer mount, a hitch, you know, a trailer hitch a device is a beautiful way of doing it. And this thing that Mel is mentioning that connects to the frame, swings out to the side, the fact that the antenna is down low, close to the road, as long as you got road clearance, that doesn't necessarily affect the performance of the antenna. Don't worry about that. What's your guess, Mel, as to the price and the brand name of this thing that you saw, and what should Don start looking for in order to search for that device if you happen to know? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, the ones I looked at, you know, I think it doesn't seem like one size fits all. It's a, it seems like they've homebrewed it from different ways. In other words, they put onto the chassis either. One I looked at actually had a little bracket welded on, like a right angle bracket piece of steel welded on to the chassis. And then this bar made out of, looks like a heavy piece of aluminum gauge, you know, nice piece of chunk of aluminum, like maybe a half inch thick by about, say, 2 inches wide, bar like material, swung out, and then on top of that was mounted an antenna mount, mount, and it, either that or another one had like what they call a gimbal mount, or so it can move a couple different ways, you know, to get a position exactly, and it looked like it was clamped basically to the chassis deck. Over.
Yeah, I'm getting the impression from what you're saying, Mel, that everything you've seen that was effective was possibly homebrew. It might not be a commercial product. I'm going to pass it back to you for a correction on that one. Second of all, almost every vehicle, you have the option of buying and installing a Class 1, a Class 2, or a Class 3 trailer hitch, depending on how heavy a trailer you want to be able to tow. So when it comes to getting metallic connection to the automobile, if there is no commercial product like the one that you're describing, I think the closest thing that Don could come to would be to buy the trailer hitch for his car and then connect the antenna to that trailer hitch. I know a fair number of people have done that. What's your opinion on all this, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Info, N2EO.
Okay, yeah. Mel and Rich in that order. Go ahead, Mel.
So feeling Rich maybe has been there and done it. So let's turn it right over to Rich.
Okay, Mel, N2EO. I personally haven't, but you know who has? Hal, K6 Delta Papa Zulu. He has two cars. He's got a guy, I don't know where it is, but I remember he just bought a car and he brought it into his guy who made him a welded a custom bumper mount hitch, whatever you want to call it, to a car. His other car has it, and his previous car has it, so I would say, I don't think he's on frequency tonight, but I would say get a hold of K6 Delta Papa Zulu, and he could probably send him right to the guy.
From what you remember, Rich, was this a custom-made device for holding the antenna, or was it possibly a variation of a trailer hitch? What's your impression there, Rich? Go ahead.
Al said, I believe it was a custom-made piece. It's mounted right in the center of the back bumper of his car. He's got two of them right now.
Dick, I just happened to be looking in Hints and Kinks in the June issue of QFT. And page 63, they think to show something like that, Dick. Over.
I have the June issue in my hand. That's the May issue. Well, here's the June issue. Okay. And the June issue in my hand. I'm dialing into page 63 as we speak. And let's see what it is. How about that? Figure 3, a detailed exploded view showing the components of the SUV mount. Okay. So, looks like page 63 of the June issue under Hints and Kinks has a suggestion. So, I think there's two ways you can go, Don. Read that article in the June issue, and that's going to help, I think. And a man who is definitely a member of this particular group is a guy named Hal. Kilowatt number 6, Delta Papa Zulu. He lives in the New York City area. He's a member of this group. He's got an email address. So one way or another, he's a guy who has done it, and I think he's going to be able to help you. Back to you for any fills on this, Don. To be A2ZOZ, K2RIW.
Zero. Outstanding, gentlemen. I will pick up that issue of QST on page 63, and it looks that you gentlemen might have come up with the solution. I was also thinking of, I heard of some hams for their quarter panels on their SUVs, the ribbon, the ground ribbon, the ground braid, having one end braised to the frame and the other end to the quarter panel. I think I might have heard another station breaking in. Go ahead.
Yeah, we only heard one letter of a word, so to speak, on both transmissions the person attempted, so he's not making it. You'll be impressed by the fact that the article is entitled No Holes SUV mount. So it implies you don't have to put any holes in the SUV, and in order to use this mounting technique, what it exactly grabs onto, I don't know yet. I haven't read the article. So let us know, come back and let us know how this works out, Don, because I think your problem that you're trying to solve guarantees that other people that want to solve it. Ed, you're up at bat. K2 Golf Julu Juliet Echo. What would you like to ask the TechNet tonight? K2RIW, you got it, Ed. K2 at Golf Juliet Echo. Are you there, Ed? Okay, if Ed comes in later, we'll pick him up at that time. What Wesley did this week is to give me a web address for a very nice set of instructional, let me find it now, there it is, YouTube. The title of it is 15 Ionization NSG Chemistry Chem Study. YouTube, once you go to YouTube video, and if you just do a search on that, the actual address is a little bit longer than that, but 15 ionization study. In other words, when you have a material that's gaseous, and they start off with sodium and hydrogen and helium and xenon and whatever, every gaseous material has what's called a ionization potential. When you shoot electrons at it with a particular number of electron volts of kinetic energy, velocity, you could call it, or if you shoot ultraviolet rays at it, if you shoot energy of known photon energy per little bundle at your particular material, each individual material has a characteristic amount of energy that's required to free up electrons, to make it into an ionized material. And then in this experiment, they had two metal plates inside that vacuum chamber, and passed a voltage between the two. That was connected to an electroscope. It's a very sensitive machine that could measure 10 to the minus 14 amperes. And when current starts flowing between the two plates that are in this chamber, you know that you have ionized material. That's what the definition of ionized material is. It's conductive. It's a gaseous conductive material. Let me drop. So that every single material that you can think of has a very characteristic amount of energy, and that is required to ionize the material. So by building this electron tube-like thing inside of this vacuum chamber, where they turned up the voltage, in some cases as little as 5 to 15 volts is all that's required on this vacuum tube, to shoot electrons into this material that they're testing. And once you know the energy of the electrons that you're shooting in, you can therefore find out what amount of energy creates the ionization. Once you know the ionization potential, you have recognized the material. So now you know what some of this kind of chromatography-like machines that you see on, what's the name of that program now?
CSI.
That's it, CSI Miami, CSI New York. They whenever they want to analyze a substance, one of the ways they can analyze the substance is to make it into a gaseous form, find out what the ionization potential is, and you look at those peaks and valleys of the curve and you say, aha, I recognize that as this kind of plastic and that kind of fluid and so on. So recognizing materials by ionization potential is what these this particular YouTube video is giving instruction on. Once you find that video, it gives you the offer of a whole lot of other scientific lectures on chemistry. And some of them are quite interesting, just like the series of lectures that were done by Feynman and others. There's a series of lectures here which give a lot of scientific information. Over to you, Wesley, and it looks like you pointed us to a pretty good one. And I know you've got a bunch of questions as to what was being demonstrated. Into XJN, K2RIW.
Into XJN. Well, I have a question about all of the links that I have sent you. I was trying to keep them to the minimum. One of them was the entertaining one by the guy from Australia who was presenting the oscilloscope with a totally short input, and when he stand up, the curve on the oscilloscope shows up. The other one was the chem study. Actually, we talking about show that is giving the information about the early stage of the radio tubes and how the tube was developed. It is giving us all of the information standing about the photon and the way that the photon interacts with the substance, and then it is able to shoot out the electron. The series of the questions that I have made a few hours ago, I was actually not very fortunate way worded, but I think you've got that. We have. Let me drop. We have a subject that I'm the most interested with. This one was only a part of the questioning that I gave, say, 1.5 hour ago. Right. I was trying to find the behavior of the photon. But later on, if you can go to Professor Stephen E. Jones, who shows the over-unity circuit with H times the power output versus the power delivered. He's a professor of Brigham Young University, serving over 4 years in that university. And I simply am astounded with the courage that Dr. Stephen had in order for him to demonstrate that circuitry. Back to you, sir.
Okay, I wonder if I received what you're speaking of. The chemistry single URL, I received that from you on Friday. The last time I had another email from you was May 19th.
May 27, 3 days ago, physicist Stephen E. Jones shows over unity circuit and measurement. And there is a wording beneath that. On May 26, 2011, Dr. Stephen E. Jones demonstrated a single solid-state circuit. He has been working on that pursuit more than 8 times the energy of the electricity put in. Do you see that?
Okay, 27th is Thursday, and I'm looking at all the emails I received, and I don't see Wesley's name in there. You're sure I was on the distribution?
That is correct, sir. I have the copy of it, and it was sent previously only to you, K2RAW. And you may recognize that by the red characters. Dick Glenn, please find the time to look at this material. It is worth of your time.
Okay. I might not have it. I may have misplaced it. Not quite sure what all has happened, Wesley. But can you ask your question at this time?
What I'm going to do is I'm going to resend it to you. I would like to, in regards to that Kemi study video that was showing the reaction of the photon in the empty, close to very high evacuation of the air molecules environment. And then they put various numbers of gases into it, and they show three particle ways of ionization. One of these ways was light. The second one was spark. The third one was heat. Let me drop. On this video, they show a prism and a very precise instrument allow you to shoot through the slit at various different frequencies of light. So red, green, ultraviolet, and so on. And they were showing how that photon behaves. I gave you a question which I don't want to reward again because I'm going to screw it up, as I did in 1 hour and a half ago. And you said, these are a four different subject. I was talking about a photon traveling from the sun, hitting the first molecule of air, and then I was talking about electromagnetic wave being not immune to the magnetic field of the magnet in the circulator. I'm trying to find out, is the radio frequency leaving Earth containing mass or not? And John said no electrons are being transmitted. So from all of these pieces of information, if you can construct properly or word properly the questioning, I would very much appreciate that. And to Jim.
Yes, I do remember seeing the chemical lecture where he was shining a light through a prism, and then the output of the prism, which normally gives you a rainbow-like spectrum, he was using a narrow slit and only allowing with the narrow slit very specific wavelengths to enter the chamber, and then measuring the ionization magnitude of the substance being tested. In one case, he was boiling off some sodium. In other cases, he was using neon or helium, argon, and things like this. And so he was studying the fact that at various wavelengths of exposure, various amounts of ionization of the material took place. In other words, the two metal plates across the material in the gaseous form being studied would experience various amounts of conductivity measured with the electroscope as those wavelengths were being applied to the substance. I think that really is gaseous chromatography. In other words, what wavelength creates what amount of ionization of that particular substance. And once you've got that curve, it is a signature that allows you to recognize that substance in the future. And I think it's very close to some of the testing you see them do on CSI Miami, among other programs. And by the way, let me drop. People who are in the forensic science area, the people who do criminal investigations, who happen to watch a program like CSI Miami, are a little bit disappointed in that the program has a degree of accuracy, but it also has a degree of exaggeration. I mean, you can see those people peel a fingerprint off of some particular substance. They apply it to a computer program, and 10 seconds later, they know exactly who it was, where he was born, where he lives, who he married. They know everything about him instantaneously. Well, it would be nice if the system worked that well. Someday it will. But it's a bit of an exaggeration. They can do things close to that, but not quite that good. But now, what's really going on with that chromatography experiment was that each individual wavelength, by way of the Planck equation, E equals H nu, E means energy, H is the Planck constant, and nu is the Greek letter representing frequency. So once you know the frequency, which really is wavelength in other terms, of a particular emission, whether it be ultraviolet or X-ray or purple or red or whatever, infrared, once you know the frequency slash wavelength of a wave, of a stream of photons, a source of energy, you now know the amount of energy that's in each one of those photons by way of the Planck equation. You expose your gaseous substance to that particular wavelength, and you measure the degree of ionization, you get that spectral signature, as I said before, allows you to recognize that material. So in the case of ultraviolet rays coming out of the sun, let me drop. The ultraviolet rays coming out of the sun have a large amount of energy, each individual photon. When they strike the upper air molecules, atoms of oxygen and nitrogen and whatever, ionization does take place. If the energy is of the right wavelength, I mean, there's a kind of resonance going on. Remember what we talked about over the years with grid dip meter. In the case of a grid dip meter, you have an oscillating circuit that you hold near a passive resonating circuit. The magic of resonance is that energy gets coupled between the two just because of proximity. I could have an inductor and a capacitor connected across each other on a table. They have a certain resonant frequency. If the oscillator of my grid dip meter happens to be running at that exact frequency right now, and I hold the coil of my grid dip meter close to that LC circuit, energy gets coupled from the grid dip meter into the LC circuit, and my grid dip meter recognizes the fact that the oscillation is no longer as strong because some of the energy was lost by that coupling.
Metal range finder.
And at the molecular level, many gaseous molecules do exactly that. In other words, the nature of the electrons that are in the first orbit, the second orbit, the third orbit around a nucleus of a molecule gives it the equivalent of a resonant frequency. If the right wavelength comes along, it is capable of kicking that electron either completely away from the molecule or at least kicking it into a higher orbit where it has absorbed the energy. It has to absorb a very specific wavelength. If you give it that specific wavelength, it absorbs it, and something happens inside that molecule. But usually when you excite a molecule, whether you've ionized it by stripping an electron away from it entirely, or if you just excited it by making that electron go to a higher orbit, almost always Mother Nature doesn't like that disturbed condition. She eventually goes back to the original condition. When the electron jumps down from the excited orbit back to the base orbit where it normally belongs, it emits an extremely specific amount of wavelength of energy. During that transition, a very specific wavelength comes out. You can measure that wavelength and again find out exactly what is the material and what was the status of the material before and after that transition, because you can measure the emission of that wavelength. You could say a laser does this, but we're talking about something much more minor than a laser. I wonder if this helps a little bit, Wesley. And I'm not a pro on this one. I'm just telling you what little I know. N2XJN, K2LIW.
N2XJN. Kind of confused with everything. At first, if we take that one of the methods of ionization is light, and we just keep it in mind, we forget about it. Then we state that a photon doesn't have a mass. It travels from the sun to the earth. But when it hits a first molecule of air, it becomes mass-carrying. What is the form of that mass-carrying photon that is not a photon any longer? Based on the video, we've seen that photon was in a total vacuum hitting a molecule of air or molecule of the gas, producing a free atom. Back to you, sir.
Welcome to the MassyNet. You make the comment. Wesley will ask stupid fucking questions for 2 hours. Everybody come now for the MassyNet.
The photon doesn't have to have any mass. If it does have mass, it's extremely small. It is energy transmitted as an electromagnetic wave. The electromagnetic wave has an E field and an H field. It does not have electrons. It's energy at a particular wavelength. And if the right wavelength comes in the vicinity of particular molecules, oxygen and nitrogen molecules that are in the upper atmosphere, because the wavelength is one of the wavelengths that molecule is sensitive to, energy gets coupled, very similar to a grid dip meter. Energy gets coupled from the incoming photon energy wave. It's not an impact. Energy gets coupled, and the method by which the molecule responds is that the electrons that are in orbit around that nucleus of that atom or molecule, let's call it atom, get excited. The method by which they are capable of absorbing energy is that the electrons that are in